Hi everyone, and welcome to the latest episode of Now and Men, the podcast on men, masculinities and gender equality. I'm Sandy Ruxton. I'm here with Stephen Burrell, as ever. How are you doing, Stephen?
Yes, I'm doing well. Thanks, Sandy. It's a little early in the morning here currently, as for the first time we're speaking from three different time zones across the world. But I'm well, thank you. Yeah, how are things at your end?
I'm fine, Stephen. I have a great spotted woodpecker who visits the bird feeder in my garden every day. And when I see it, as I did today, it just gives me a little lift in mood. So I'm feeling quite good about my communing with nature there. And I find it helps a little, you know, in this topsy-turvy world we live in.
Absolutely. No, I can certainly relate to that. No, that's lovely. Yeah, but for today's episode, we'd like to introduce you to Dr. Jocelyn Smith-Lee. Jocelyn is an assistant professor of human development and family studies at the University of North Carolina in Greensboro in the United States. And we're here to talk about her research on experiences of trauma, gun violence, loss and healing among black men, boys and families.
Yes, Jocelyn is the founder and director of the Centering Black Voices Research Lab at the University of North Carolina. And she's also the founder and project lead for In All Ways Human, which is a visual storytelling campaign that seeks to disrupt dehumanising narratives of black male criminality and reclaim effectively the humanity of black boys and men. So thank you so much for joining us today, Jocelyn, on the podcast. Perhaps to start off with, could you set out the context of your research a little bit in terms of gun violence in the United States? Just how prevalent an issue is this, and for black men and boys in particular?
Sure. Thank you so much, Sandy and Stephen. I'm really delighted to be with you today, and yes, across our trio of continents. So, you know, gun violence is a serious public health concern in the United States. The U.S. exceeds its peer nations with respect to firearm violence annually. We see, particularly in the past couple of years, upwards of 40,000 gun deaths each year in the United States. And just over half of those are by suicide, and also then we see the homicide deaths happening. And for decades, this health disparity has buffeted Black families. So for decades, homicide has been the leading cause of death, particularly for Black youth, and now it's the leading cause of death for Black males ages 1 through 44. So really threatening safe and stable transitions into and beyond young adulthood for Black males in the United States. And we also see, particularly within the context of the pandemic, more research has been attuned to the ways that firearm violence is also impacting Black women. So as a whole, Black family systems have had to wrestle with the multiplicity of homicide deaths within their families. We tend to use the term homicide survivor to describe a friend or family member who is tasked with the grief or the journey of having to live on after a loved one is murdered. And for Black Americans, that descriptor, homicide survivor, is masking a multiplicity of homicide deaths. And for the young men that I was really blessed to work with, privileged to work with, honored to work with in East Baltimore, where my work started, that meant on average losing three friends or family members to gun violence, largely before the age of 24. So this is a significant issue within the context of the United States, but it has burdened Black families unequally for decades. And we're starting to see, though, because again, with the surge of gun violence following the pandemic, we're now seeing gun violence be a leading cause of death for all children. And because of that, we're paying more closely attention to this longstanding disparity within the African-American community within the United States.
Wow, those are terrifying statistics that you're citing there. But you just mentioned you started off with your work in East Baltimore, and you also now work in Greensboro as well. Do you want to say just a little bit more about those areas and how those issues play out in those locations?
Sure. So, yes, I always describe our work as rooted in East Baltimore and now growing in Greensboro. And that's the case for me because of having done my doctoral training at the University of Maryland. And so Baltimore became kind of a second home for me and really the birthplace of this program of research. And then Greensboro because of where I am situated currently as a faculty member at UNCG. And although these cities are different in scale in terms of Greensboro being a smaller city compared to Baltimore, which is a major city within the United States, the histories with respect to racial discrimination and the structural forces that really organize our lives and organize space and place, those same root causes of violence are present across both places. So in Greensboro, although not the same in terms of numbers, the proportion of Black Americans who are victimized by gun violence each year is very patterned and very similar. And so we have two cities that are really wrestling with these issues and trying to help figure out how to support families as they heal. You know, I come to this work, and I always say there's a professional pathway to it and a personal pathway to this work. So professionally, when I was a doctoral scholar at the University of Maryland in Family Science and in a School of Public Health, a doctoral mentor got a grant from the William T. Grant Foundation to examine the transition to adulthood for economically disadvantaged young men of color. So thinking about, in particular, Latinx young men and Black young men. And so the work with respect to understanding that developmental context for Black young men took us to East Baltimore. And we partnered with a GED and Job Readiness Training Center there. And I was really entrusted with doing a lot of the community relationship building at that site. And in the very first qualitative interview we did that was designed, again, to learn about this journey of adulthood, we asked young men, you know, tell me about your neighborhood. And the young men start talking at length and without prompting about the violence in their neighborhood and the people they were losing as a result of that violence. And so on the surface, it seemed as if I was asking a question about place, but the young men were responding by telling me who was dying as a function of the social conditions within that place, within their neighborhood. And so that caught my full attention, one, because of the seriousness of what they were sharing, but also because, and here's the personal, it felt like a mirror was being held up for me, where I immediately began reflecting on growing up outside of Philadelphia in Pennsylvania and the people I lost as a result of gun violence, my cousin when I was 16 years old, and then a series of friends as I graduated high school, went to college, and even as I was training to be a couple and family therapist, getting calls in the clinic that close friends had been murdered. And so it was in that moment that the dots of the lived experiences of the young men in Baltimore were getting connected with the dots in my own lived experience, again with the shared, the common denominator being the root causes in both places. But it was really kind of illuminating this picture for me of the unaddressed pain and unaddressed trauma and grief of gun violence in the lives of young Black men. And so even as I came across my professional journey to Greensboro, arriving here when they were experiencing historic rates of gun violence and finding the same need, it has also, you know, just reinforced and reinvigorated my commitment to this work.
Gosh, I'm sorry to hear about your personal loss there as well. I mean, that's pretty traumatizing for the whole of your family, I guess. But one of the reasons we wanted to talk to you was because, you know, your perspective seems to be quite different from, you know, the more sort of commonplace ones, which are about the violence itself, whereas you're talking about the traumatizing impact that the violence has on particularly Black men and boys, you know, and the numbers of young men that they will have known who've been killed and so on and so forth. Do you want to say a bit more about the multiple impacts of that violence?
Absolutely. So in East Baltimore, I began conducting in-depth interviews with young men ages 18 to 24, so really thinking about this transition to adulthood, this period that we, you know, traditionally consider emerging adulthood. And as part of the interviews, in part informed by this intersectional conversation that was happening with me as a young Black woman and Black men sitting across from me, mindful that men are socialized differently with respect to discussions about emotion, discussions about pain and vulnerability, and also that the research suggests, and we might look at our lives and comment, that we grieve differently as well. And so with men being known for being instrumental grievers, I had young men do something so that we weren't just talking with each other the whole time. If I slow myself down, I'll also say that I intentionally, at the outset of the interview, created space to acknowledge those differences and invite them to be fully human with me. Meaning that if, while we're having these conversations, liquid might form in their eyes and roll down their cheeks, that would be a signal of their shared humanity and not an indication of weakness from my standpoint. So as a trained clinician, that was intentional for me to clear space for that, in a sense, to signal safety and permission to be fully human with me. But then we did something, so we weren't just talking the whole time. So I had young men construct what I call chronologies of loss. And so these were timelines that they would co-create with me, where they draw a line from one end of the page to the other, mark off all the years they experienced a loss, and then particularly identify those that were a result of homicide. And so for those 40 young men that I spoke with, on average, that's where that average of 3 deaths come from with respect to homicide was present. For one young man, he disclosed losing 10 friends or family members to gun violence, again, as a young person in the early 20s. So one, just the profound impact of this, of not having time out to grieve any singular experience of homicide death before another one is introduced, is important to acknowledge and understand. And that those deaths aren't happening in isolation, that there are other deaths that are also happening simultaneously that are really crowding for me this period of transition to adulthood for young men. And as we think about that context, this period where you are constructing what life might be like for you, your vision for yourself in concert or in contrast with your peers, economically disadvantaged young Black men, and as I'm speaking to with the work in Baltimore, are tasked to do that in the context of a dying peer cohort. So having to bury your peers on multiple occasions, that's something that might seem normative for my 86-year-old grandmother. But this is something that 18 and even younger, right, are being tasked to do. So really seeing grief and traumatic grief as a developmental task for young people and young Black men, in particular Black boys and men, is really important to acknowledge, because that grief gets carried invisibly with them into school, into work, into home relationships and peer relationships, and shapes the way that they form connections, but also are navigating those spaces. And because of the racialized context in the United States, that pain is too often misinterpreted as perhaps problem behavior or attitudinal issues. And instead of it being an opportunity to connect to healing, it often is a pathway to more punitive responses, which can, you know, spiral into reinforcing some of those disparities we see within the justice system and elsewhere. So the profound, the volume, the impact by way of mental health. We also think about traumatic stress or PTSD as a response to something, an event, or a period, war, for example. And then there's supposed to be some reprieve from that. But because this violence is largely happening in neighborhood context where there may not be economic or social capital to relocate, then it's happening in a context of no post, where there is no reprieve to try and get back to equilibrium and find a level place to then recover and, you know, be positioned to rebound and thrive. So resilience is happening in a very complex context for Black boys and their families. And that's the work that I really learned from their stories in East Baltimore.
And are there identifiable sort of turning points when, you know, young men can, I don't know what the right term would be, exit from the context that they're surrounded by? Or is that, does it not work that way? Is it very individual?
Yeah, so for some, you know, we do think about there's a body of work that examines post-traumatic growth, that from pain, growth can happen. And I hear that in the stories of some of the young men who, you know, think about these moments as a period of redemption or generativity, so that this pain kind of motivates them to live on and achieve things for their deceased loved one. So my cousin was murdered and he can't graduate high school, so now I am super motivated to do that. Or, you know, my friend was murdered and he can't go on and have a family, and I want that for myself and for him. So there's some of that. But the guys talk about it as this kind of perceived life expectancy. So if I can get to 20, 25, 26, it's different across the guys, but there's this threshold in their minds that if I can just get to that birthday, then there will be some clearance for me to experience safety or be free from having to navigate this in such a chronic way. And when I re-interviewed young men about 3.5 years after that original conversation with them, many of them had aged beyond that, but we're also wrestling now with this renegotiation. For example, if I tell you of a young man I call Ramel, in his mind, 25 was the marker. He looks at his family history and he's noticing that the firstborn male in his family has been murdered for 2 generations. And so he's feeling this pressure, but also this motivation to have a different experience, to create a different story and legacy in his family. And he says, if I can get to 25, like, I know that I will have exceeded their life expectancies and I can create something better for myself. He turns 25. And then within the month, in an attempted robbery, just, you know, that happens in cities, he's shot in both legs. And thankfully survived those injuries, but had to relearn to walk. And he's a father, so he's got a young daughter and a toddler son, and they're both trying to figure this out now that dad is in a wheelchair. And while that hurt him from a perspective of masculinity and feeling like he couldn't get up and do for himself, he couldn't work at that time, the thing he says that broke him was having his school-aged daughter say, you know, Dad, when I become an adult, am I going to get shot too? And so here he is, having made it to 25, and now having to renegotiate those things all over again, renegotiate what safety means, what protection means. And that's happening in the same context of, if you think back to Baltimore, in the context of Freddie Gray's murder in that city. And so now young men are also, they'd already been telling me about police violence in their lives before we were sounding the alarm nationally and internationally about that. But now there's this public case that they're all wrestling with too. So there's this duality of vulnerability from community violence and from police violence that they're trying to figure out. I am pleased to share that young man, Ramel, has gone on into his 30s. And he is with us and, you know, continuing to nurture his children and be in relationship and in community. But that is a task I wish that young black men did not have, in particular economically disadvantaged young black men, did not have to. That's not a calculus I wish was stealing of their intellectual and psychological energies, relational energies on a daily basis.
Mm. I mean, why do you think it is, Jocelyn, that the issues you're looking at are so infrequently discussed, you know, when it comes to debates about gun violence and crime in the United States? You know, why do you think it is that we're so reluctant to consider the idea of vulnerability and victimization and trauma among black men and boys in particular?
Yes, and I really appreciate that question. It is what has pushed me into the space of really thinking about and addressing dehumanization as a root cause of violence in the context of the United States. And we have a really complicated racial history that has relied upon dominant negative narratives about who black people are, in particular who black men are. These stories that we have told about, in particular, black male criminality, bestiality, being these violent animals that need to be tamed, that, you know, justified our country's institution of slavery, the racial terror that followed in terms of lynching in the United States. But if we think about and what those words are, you know, thug, criminal, lazy, predator. We've heard them from the political sphere. We've heard them in the everyday. They're reinforced. Those images and stories are reinforced in media, all sorts of media. And so there's this coupling together in the psyche of our nation of violence and blackness. And that leaves you with a singular narrative of criminal, of perpetrator of violence. And so we don't have a problem in the United States of talking about blackness, of black men as violent, as those committing offenses. That's easy for us to talk about. But it's harder for us to talk about black men as victims, as the injured, as the harmed, because that requires us to acknowledge the fullness of humanity. And we just are not there.
Mm. And so is this what motivated your campaign, In Always Human? Yeah, I mean, could you tell us a bit more about that, about the approach you've adopted with that and what you wanted to achieve with it?
It is, you know, having done this research and done the responsible academic thing of, you know, publish it in peer review outlets and presented at scientific meetings, the thing that became apparent to me time and time again is I noticed even when I am preparing to give talks that I am intentionally working very hard to situate these experiences in context, in a historical context, because it's so easy whenever you mention violence to activate those negative stereotypes about black men and to have that competing in the background of people's minds with the stories of young men's vulnerability. That makes it hard for you to really hear and connect. So I noticed myself doing that hard work of taking minutes upon minutes to make sure the audience was ready to receive the information that I was going to be sharing with them. I noticed myself, and we began, even in the labs I work with in Maryland, getting permission to take pictures of participants so that we, again, were not activating stereotypes of statistics, rather inviting people to connect with real human beings, and so including those images in our presentations. And so all of that work really pointed towards the need to, yes, do the research, the need to, yes, as a clinician, create spaces within, like I did in Baltimore and I am in Greensboro, within these centers of creating safe spaces for young men to come and begin to tell their stories. But also we need to do the work of addressing root causes. Otherwise, these disparities will just be maintained over time. And so In Always Human is our effort to spread the simple yet profound truth that Black boys, men, and their families are always, whether a tiny toddler like my 3-year-old or a teenager, whether young adult or young at heart, whether GED pursuing or college educated, whether community member or celebrity, that we are always and in every fiber of our being, every presentation of ourselves, whether we are living or even deceased because of the ways that we have criminalized even the dead, that we are always and in always human and deserving of dignity, of safety, of care, and of opportunity. So we've been intentional about this. In part, COVID pivots required us to. We received the funding in May of 2020 and had conceived of this Photo Voice project where you partner with community and equip them with the skills of photography and the tools necessary for them to document their own lives. But with the rippling effects of COVID, we moved to a more controlled project of doing portraits. And so these portraits that we've taken, 50 from boys ages 2 to elders ages 77, has allowed us to create a space for Black boys and men to show up as they wish to be seen and to push back against those negative images that circulate in the nightly news. They're Black and white portraits, which is an intentional counterpoint to the mugshot images that often circulate in the nightly news, to foreground the humanity, the dignity, the resilience of the Black boys and men participating in our project, and then interviewing them to ask them what they want the world to know about who they are and how they wish to be seen. And in doing so, we hope that this work will begin to reclaim the humanity. And we've been intentional about our dissemination. So we blew up those portraits in life size and installed them alongside the wall of a closed elementary school, which is situated one block from our GED center and a block and a half from Johns Hopkins Medical Campus. It stares at, so this former historic elementary school was closed, deemed failing, and stares at a gentrified neighborhood. The city would reframe it as a neighborhood revitalization project. And so it stares at the new residents of this neighborhood in a place where existing Black residents have been pushed out to create clear space, knock down, demolish old houses, and build these new residential living spaces. So it's an intentional placement of Black boys and men at a site where they had been pushed out or tend to be over-policed and punished, and also puts their images in conversation with Johns Hopkins Medical Campus, where too often the only encounters that the health workers have are with Black men when they're coming in for injuries. And so we hope that it is an action that will again spark dialogue about who Black men are, really, the fullness of their lives, and an investment in their well-being.
I was just going to make the point that the photo project is a very fascinating sort of counterpoint to what you were talking about earlier, about the life stories of individual young men, you know, who couldn't see beyond age 25. You're presenting them with a kind of a collective life course, if you like, which is positive. And I just thought it was interesting. There's a sort of juxtaposition there going on, isn't there? And a sort of negative positive construction, I suppose. I don't know if that makes sense, but that's what I was hearing when I was listening to you talk.
Yes, Sandy, thank you for that. It was an intentional life course presentation. So life course engagement, but also as we pasted those life-size portraits on the side of that closed elementary school. We went from youngest and tried to go through an age progression on the wall there so that there would be this visual of aging there and also these intergenerational relationships. And we began, it really hit us as we were pasting them, that this was a mural of the living. Too often in our cities, when we see murals happen of young Black men, they are once murals reflecting the dead, those who have been painted or spray painted in order to honor someone who had died. But here we are celebrating Black boys and men in life and not just death, which is also an intentional counterpoint to what attracts national attention. Typically, it is these high profile instances of police violence where a Black boy or man has lost their lives. And so it's an intentional counterpoint to that, to center Black boys and celebrate them in life and not just in death. And again, invite those key stakeholders and decision makers whose seats of power and their decisions inform the well-being of Black Americans to make investments in them while they are here, while they are living.
I wanted to ask you a little bit more about the police violence as well, because I saw a very striking quote from one of your research participants who said, I think, that they destroy, meaning the police, they destroy more than they protect. You know, and I'm wondering what it's like to fear such a sort of powerful institution on a day-to-day basis, and one which is meant to keep you safe. You know, it's extraordinary, really, isn't it?
It is. And for the young men that I worked with, there really was this, again, thinking about life course, there was this pattern that emerged in their stories that when they were young boys, their primary observations of the police was of them intervening in the lives of older Black men in ways that were violent, that were in ways that were very clear abuses of power, that these agents who were commissioned to protect and serve were violating safety for the men that they grew up with. I think of a young man in Baltimore who talked about literally being home from school and talking with his mom and his stepfather about his excelling in school, that he had been doing well, and they were encouraging him, and they were doing that on the front steps when all of a sudden the police roll up and they take the stepfather figure into the alleyway and begin physically assaulting him and questioning him about things, and never detained him, never took him away, but he was beaten so badly that they had to seek medical intervention. And so what it means to have those everyday moments of your life where you are seemingly celebrating something worthy of acclaim and worthy of esteem, and then have that come crashing down by a state institution showing up and without any punishment or accountability, harming someone that you love. And so young boys watched that. And then as they aged, whether they were teenagers or just looked, their bodies looked old enough to be, they started then experiencing that for themselves, the harassment on a regular basis, on a weekly basis. Not being able to walk down the street and cross the corner without having, you know, police pat you down. Ricky in that paper talks about that dehumanizing experience of constantly being pat down, of having your genitals, you know, explored for drugs and having nothing, you know, but having to walk away and try to reclaim your humanity, try to pull back your dignity from those experiences. And he names the emotions of what that feels like as well. So the psychological toll of that. And then, you know, again, as they aged, being subject to those physical assaults, where, again, they may not be detained, but they may be beat up badly. And then living with the threat that hanging over their heads. And then as they moved into emerging adulthood, being old enough to now know people in their community who lost their lives as a result of police violence, names that we will never know, that never made the nightly news, which really signaled to me, and this was a decade ago, you know, signaling to me the embeddedness of that violence in their daily lives, way beyond what our public health surveillance was able to track or even thinking to track at that time. So that vulnerability of moving through your neighborhood unsure of, you know, whether someone will hop out, a police officer will hop out on you and chase you down or pat you down or incarcerate you, take you away from your family. Antoine, whose quote that you reference, they destroy more than they protect. He's saying that from lived experience of having a friend murdered by the police, of having a friend be shot in the head by the police, and then, you know, but no one being held accountable for that, and somehow that being justifiable force, right? And he's talking about that from having a plainclothes police officer come up on his porch and start trouble, just start picking, instigating fights with him and his friends. And again, having no accountability for that. And he's talking about that in terms of, he says, when a police officer is driving by, right, and he's doing the calculus of, does he calmly continue walking or does he start to run because he's not sure of the danger that may come from their presence. Right? He's offering us insight into why Black men may run if they see a police officer. Because there's always this public interrogation of, well, why are you running if you have nothing to hide? If there's no culpability, why are you running? But they're running because they know how young Black men are running, because they know how quickly those moments can become lethal for them. So fight or flight is a human instinct that we have when we, you know, are fearful of what can happen, and gets activated as a trauma response from past experiences. And so it's unimaginable for many, right? And it's an unfair burden that young men are tasked with not having someone who is there who they can count on to protect them when they are in danger.
I wondered, you know, are there other services that are more supportive? I mean, I think you worked, if I'm right, in East Baltimore with mental health clinicians, and you ran groups with them. Were they, you know, a more effective way of actually engaging with, reaching, talking to, communicating with young Black men?
Absolutely, yes. And just to close the loop there, because I'm, you know, Antoine is just on my mind, the young man who said they destroy more than they protect. When I re-interviewed a couple of years later following the murder of Freddie Gray, you know, he asked the question, you know, who will protect us from the protectors? And that really is, I think, you know, summarizes well the tension and the trauma that Black communities are navigating. Who will protect us from the protectors? And he's asking that as a father of young children who's trying to keep them safe, but also, you know, wondering who will help keep him safe. The GED center that I worked at and partnered with was incredible. You know, they were primarily providing GED and job readiness training services.
Do you want to just explain GED?
Yeah, so a general education diploma.
Right.
So in the U.S., if a student does not complete high school through a traditional means, so a sequential engagement with their education that results in a graduation and a, you know, being conferred your high school diploma, then students can engage with other services in order to get their diploma. So it may not have come from a high school, but the state can issue a diploma to you. And so this center was such a center. So a place where Baltimore youth, starting at around age 16, who may have been pushed out, dropped out of high school, had some interruption in their education, could come and learn the material. So there were instructors there. In fact, a veteran GED instructor, Mr. Zizwe Alette, is the photographer for the In Always Human Project. So he knows the participants very well and has built trust with them. But yeah, they can come take classes. And this particular center was working to provide what we call wraparound services. So mindful that your high school diploma may not be all you need. So they were also doing job readiness training, so trying to connect young people to employment, and also doing offering mental health services. Of course, the investment in the clinicians there was always, that was always the funding question, whether they would have enough money to continue to fund a clinician, and that has waned and been robust and been depleted over time. So that hasn't always been consistently present. And that's why, as someone entering the space who had a license to practice, it was very important to me to provide my services in the center. And so, recognizing that those clinicians were already overburdened, I offered to create the loss and grief groups that were facilitated each week at the center. And they quickly became the highest and most frequently attended of the groups at the center, which to me again spoke to young people's need and desire to have a place to begin to unpack those experiences of traumatic loss and to heal. And there are, again, tropes and narratives that we create about Black men's participation in research and their engagement in mental health. And some of that is informed by our historical misgivings in terms of the wrongs, the ethical wrongs committed in research and the ethical wrongs committed in the context of therapy with Black Americans. But I have found that when you show up time and time again, when you show yourself trustworthy, that Black men are more than ready to begin to process that pain and to heal and recover. If I give one anecdote about that, it would be a participant whose interview lasted 4 hours, uninterrupted. Nobody got up, nobody went to the bathroom, and he was ready. He was hungering for such a space to begin to unpack the experiences of loss in his life. And I am so forever grateful that he entrusted me with that.
So, I mean, would you say it is possible to heal, you know, from these traumas, like repetitive traumas, often from a really young age? Like, have you seen, you know, some men kind of, yeah, go on a process of healing from that? And if so, like, what kind of things do help with that, in addition to what you've already said, I guess? Yeah.
Indeed. So yes, healing is possible, and that is so important to mention and emphasize. I think of a young man who just became a father on Christmas Eve. He married his high school sweetheart, and he was the very first participant that I interviewed for this project, and he had lost his father. His father was murdered when he was very young. And some of the key ingredients in his life, and I've noticed in the lives of other participants as well, are faith and spirituality. So that is not uncommon for Black Americans as an instrumental resource of how to navigate oppression and racism and trauma in the context of the United States. But that's also true for young Black men too, that there is a resource that and strength and healing that comes from engagement with faith communities, as well as one's own kind of relationship with God or a higher power. Relationship being also very healing. So whether that relationship is close adults, like you might get connected to at a GED center, which for this young man in particular, mentors were available to him in that space, father figures, you know, for this young man who had lost his father to homicide in his church, in his community, were very helpful and instrumental to him. And then also, I found as the young men have gotten older and partnered, that the relationships with their partners have been healing. And as they've become fathers, there's also been this kind of generativity that has birthed healing in their lives, this joy that has come from being a father and being able to pour into one's life. Connected to mental health services, so definitely don't want to discount that, and the need to have culturally and contextually informed clinicians. So we talk a lot about having culturally informed or prepared clinicians, but contextually informed, meaning a lot of mental health practitioners are not living in the same neighborhoods, not navigating the same threats as the young men. And so oftentimes that can lead to suggesting strategies that don't really take into account the realities and the chronicity of violence they're navigating. But having clinicians who are contextually informed, who can help them, for example, in one of my papers I write about young men's strategies of staying on point, of never letting their guard down. So this hypervigilance that we tend to think of as negative over time in response to trauma, that is safety generating for Black men. And so understanding that as a clinician, so you're not undoing some of those strategies in order to, in your work with young Black men. So, and then thinking about neighborhoods and safety. So we've got this historic backdrop of residential segregation. Baltimore was the first municipality in the United States. It gets credit for inventing legal residential segregation. And so it's also really important, you know, as we're thinking about the work of In Always Human and thinking about long-term inputs, to thinking about what those structural inputs are, like safe access to safe housing and affordable housing, and jobs that can allow you to afford, you know, even what we consider affordable housing. All of those inputs also are necessary to think about a holistic picture of what it means to heal individually, but as a community as well.
I was also wondering, because you mentioned about the vital role of relationships, about, yeah, where women and girls fit into this as well, because presumably they're also being hugely impacted by this gun violence and losing loved ones. And yeah, so, I mean, could you say a bit more about that?
Yes. So when I came to Greensboro as a faculty member, it was really important to me to start, one, because I was back in my home discipline of human development and family studies, but also because of the lessons that I learned from the work in Baltimore, to start thinking about how to do this work in families. And so our Healing Greensboro project really seeks to understand the aftermath of homicide in the lives and violent injury in the lives of Black families, to really understand how Black parents and their children are communicating, coping, and constructing meaning about vulnerability and exposures to gun violence. And so that was motivated by, one, thinking about, yes, you know, who are the other family members? You know, I'm a Black woman myself, so obviously I've been impacted by these issues and concerned about them. I now mother a daughter, and so I'm also very, you know, mindful and invested about making sure that she is healthy and that she's able to engage in healthy relationship as she moves through her life and engage with peers and others. And so this project has allowed us to do that. We've recruited Black parents, and those parents initially were mothers and their sons to engage in focus groups with us. And we are really doing that work now of unpacking what it means to mother in the context of vulnerability and violence. Again, because of our own intersectional experiences as members of the Centering Black Voices Research Lab, of being women who are doing this work and mothers who are doing this work. But the incredible resilience that it takes to mother in this context, to love in the context of vulnerability, is really worthy of exploration, and is what we will continue to do.
Can I ask, actually, in relation to women and girls, you know, in practice, is it that, you know, women and girls take on quite a lot of responsibility for, in a way, healing young black men? You know, it could be incredible pressure on them, both to deal with their own issues, but also, you know, you've got to solve things for your young men as well. Or is that not right?
Yeah, and you know, there has been incredible labor that black women have done, both, you know, women and families, period, but black women and families, particularly for the care of a family, for the care of men and boys, but also for liberation. So intersectionally, black women have been burdened with a lot of this work, but black women have also have unique insight and perspective about what it takes to nurture, to love, and to heal in the context of vulnerability and violence. And so if we're thinking about unequal burdens, yes, I think that there is an unequal burden placed on black women. This is not just black women's work. And certainly we need an investment from all of us in order to really see us advance as a whole.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and kind of connected to that, the last question I had was just around, I'm under the understanding that there's been a 20% drop in the homicide rate in Baltimore over the past year, which obviously isn't anywhere near enough when the rate was over 300 homicides a year previously, but still it is progress. Could you say anything about, you know, what you're aware lies behind this reduction? And I suppose what you would like to see more broadly in terms of like political change, you know, to help address the issues you're talking about.
Absolutely. And so we 100% celebrate that decline in homicide within the city of Baltimore. I think there's a lot of work to do to still fully understand the mechanisms that have produced that change. And we are hopeful that it will be sustained for the years to come and decline even further. There have been some investments, and I really celebrate my colleagues in this space with respect to community violence intervention. And, you know, politically, we have seen a bipartisan bill passed with respect to investing in safer communities. And that has funded some additional work of community violence intervention, where we've seen trusted members of the community be trained to do the work of violence interruption within cities. And we celebrate that and request that further investment be made in those efforts as well. For sure, the investment that was made was significant, but we need more in terms of federal dollars that can, you know, be allocated to states and jurisdictions to do the work of trying to reduce gun violence in our cities, in our states, which disproportionately claim the lives of Black Americans. For me, as someone who has done the work of understanding trauma and loss created by gun violence, I also want to see that there's investment in, equal investment in the mental health and the well-being, so that healing can also come. So not just a reduction in violence, but that an investment in healing, and that should mirror the scale of the issue as well. And so, yeah, I would love to see lawmakers thinking about that, and also thinking about, you know, the investment in those structural pieces that help construct safety in communities with respect to housing and, you know, respect to education and employment, all of those other ingredients that also produce safe communities.
Wow, there's so much to do, isn't there? I don't know whether you feel positive about the future prospects or not, really, given the mountain that you're climbing. But let's hope for positive change.
I am hopeful, you know, and I am hopeful because of the stories of the young men, that even though there has been such pain in their lives, when I was in Baltimore and watching them show up day after day in pursuit of their GED, in pursuit of employment, after all they'd been through. Right? They are the embodiment of resilience, although I do not think it's fair that they have to be resilient to all of that. And so that's the work of changing the context of making those structural investments so that they don't have to be so resilient for all of those things. But their ability to show up time after time and to continue on provides the most sustainable source of hope that I have. So I am hopeful.
Oh, good. No, it's great to end on a hopeful note. And I just wanted to thank you for spending time with us and talking to us about your fantastic work. It sounds just incredible what you're doing. So thank you very much for that, and all best wishes for, you know, your future projects.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, no, I feel hopeful talking to you, Jocelyn, and hearing about the great work people like you are doing. So thank you.
Thank you so much, Sandy and Stephen. And I know you'll put the link in the notes of the chat for folks to come visit us at inalwayshuman.com or follow us on our socials. And we look forward to connecting.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We will. Thank you so much.
Do that.
Oh, Sandy, that was certainly a very, I was really kind of touched and moved and inspired by what Jocelyn said there, really, and what she shared with us. But also, obviously, just very shocked and appalled about the situation that she was describing. What did you make of the conversation?
Yeah, well, same as you, really. I mean, it's very shocking what she's describing. And, I mean, the scale of it is just phenomenal. I can hardly get my brain around it, you know. I mean, the idea that in a city like Baltimore of, I don't know, 500,000 people, there can be regularly 300 homicides per year. I mean, I know that figure's gone down a bit in the last year. I think it was about 260, 263. But, you know, those figures are just extraordinary. And I mean, I looked up the figures for the UK, or England and Wales, sorry, to be more specific. I mean, there were 590 homicides in the year ending March 2023. You know, it's just amazing to think that one American city can produce so many homicides. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there are obviously others as well that have very high death toll. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in particular, the racial component of it as well, the fact that it's predominantly black men and boys who are dying.
Yeah, it is incredibly shocking, isn't it? Especially when we think that this is predominantly like young people as well. Like, you know, and how normalized this is from a really young age. Like often when people are still children, to have the kind of traumatic experiences or the experience of loss that Jocelyn was talking about. I also, something that struck me in one of her pieces of writing was about how, I suppose, the narrative around school shootings in the US, because obviously that's something which is discussed a lot in the news. But I feel like predominantly, you know, it's predominantly white faces that you see, you know, in the news, or, you know, that's when it's taken seriously. But in one of her papers, she discusses how, you know, it's black children are much more likely to be victims in school shootings as well. And that's not something which I think is discussed very much. But one thing which also I couldn't help but think about, which it would have been great to ask about, but there wasn't time to discuss it more, but it's around masculinity, you know, and of course, the role that's playing in the violence itself, but also in terms of these young men's experiences and their ability to talk about these things, right? I'm sure for lots of, you know, men and boys who have experiences of loss and trauma and bereavement, you know, it must be very difficult for them to feel able to share what they're going through with others, because that isn't seen as something very masculine, is it? Especially when we have these expectations that, on black men in particular, right, that they should be tough and invulnerable and stoical and these kinds of things, perhaps. So, you know, just disclosing the fact that you feel afraid of this violence, that you feel afraid of the police, you know, this institution which is supposed to be there to protect you, but afraid to the point that if you see the police near you, you might run because you're so afraid of them. You know, I think disclosing that kind of thing is very difficult, I think, for lots of young men, isn't it? So actually, I think it shows as well how well Jocelyn has done in her research to elicit these stories and to make these young men feel able to share these things with her.
I think the approach is interesting as well. I mean, I looked at one of her videos, and she mentioned that you know, the way of engaging was not a sort of pathologizing approach, so, you know, what's wrong with you, but more about what's happened to you, actually, you know, and this notion that, you know, young men's voices and experiences need to be at the center if you're going to achieve any positive change. You know, that seems to be quite an important component, and I think we've heard that elsewhere as well. She also made me think, by the way, of the previous episode that we did with Nate Eisenstadt. You know, and he talked quite a bit about punishment and the failings of a punishment-based approach, and, you know, the importance of support, of care, and so on. And actually, there's some real resonance with the approach that Jocelyn is adopting as well, don't you think?
Absolutely. Especially when you think that, like, the vast majority of men in prison have themselves experienced trauma, right, of the kind that Jocelyn's talking about. So actually, these things... Yeah, actually, often you can't necessarily separate out victims from perpetrators of violence, can you, in that way? And I think that, actually, if we want to address the root causes of violence, I think this is really something we do need to be talking about, isn't it?
And the other thing, of course, was to end on, you know, her message of hope.
Absolutely.
Really. Yeah. You know, which, given what she described in terms of the context, is incredible, really, to maintain hope in such difficult circumstances. And, you know, all you can think is more power to her and her organisations and, you know, people working with her, really.
Yeah, no, I was really moved by how hopeful and optimistic she was, you know, in the context of dealing with such horrific issues. Yeah, I think that's probably enough for today, isn't it, Sandy? But thank you so much, everybody, for listening, as always. We'll be back with another episode soon. As always, do subscribe if you haven't done so already. If you listen to us on Apple Podcasts, please do leave us a review or a rating. That would be great. And, yeah, take care of yourselves and do contact us at nowatmen@gmail.com if you have any questions or comments. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks from me too.
Bye. Bye.
Bye now.